Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and the hospital's minimally invasive gynecologic surgery program, led by doctors Anouk Lambers and Siobhan Hayden, saratogahospital.org, to learn more. Joining us for Medical Monday today is neurosurgeon Dr. Julie Politsis of Albany Medical Center. And Dr. Politsis specializes in the use of deep brain stimulation to treat people with Parkinson's and other illnesses. We'll talk about that. Also, Dr. Politsis has an interest in the surgical management of chronic pain, and we'll talk about that as well. And whatever you want to talk about, our number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 800-348-2551. It's Neurology Today. Your call's coming up. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday today is neurologist Dr. Julie Politsis of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Politsis is a neurosurgeon at Albany Med and a professor of neurosurgery at Albany Medical College. Dr. Politsis specializes in the use of deep brain stimulation to treat patients with essential tremor, Parkinson's disease, and dystonia. She has also a special interest in the surgical management of chronic pain, specifically using stimulation techniques, and performs general adult brain and spine surgeries. Dr. Politsis completed a fellowship in functional neurosurgery at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, a residency in neurosurgery at Wayne State University in Detroit, where she also earned her PhD in neurophysiology. She earned her medical degree from Albany Medical College. If you have a question for Dr. Politsis, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Julie Politsis, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really great to have you here. Let's start by talking about pain. We have all experienced pain. It's part of the human condition. Tell me, what exactly happens? I'm walking barefoot. I step on a tack. My brain says I am feeling pain. What exactly happens?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you feel pain because the receptors and nerves involved in pain are anywhere from, you know, the sole of your foot where you've stepped on that tack up to the mid-leg, up to the full leg and the spinal cord, through the brain stem and then to the brain. So the signals have to get all the way up to that pain processing area. And, you know, then kind of a light bulb goes on in that brain processing area. And then a signal comes all the way back down there to say, you know, move your foot. And, you know, that differs when it's something sharp versus something dull versus something hot or cold. But, you know, that's part of the response that we have to protect our bodies.
Do we know everything there is to know about pain, or are there still mysteries?
Oh, there's lots of mysteries. You know, right now, unfortunately, so many things are subjective. So, you know, we have to tell other people what we're feeling when we feel pain because there aren't a lot of good markers, you know, that we can see on MRI or other things that allow an objective way of looking at this.
It's really, I find this fascinating, and your line of work especially fascinating. I think the brain is about the most mysterious thing you can imagine. But as somebody who has tinkered with electrical stuff and electronics, I'm fascinated by the physics and the physical nature of how a signal goes through, say, from where I step on that tack all the way up to my brain. What is it? I assume it's an electrical signal. How long does it take to get there?
So, you know, it works. It is mostly an electrical signal, though, you know, and in fact, Very similar to electrical wires, you know, there's kind of insulation that lets it go faster. So, you know, when people talk about having like multiple sclerosis, there's a problem with that insulation. Or that also can happen when people have diabetes in their fingers and their toes, where, you know, there's a problem with that electrical signal getting through. And the majority of the signal is electrical up until it gets to the brain. But, you know, there are a series of biochemical things that happen as well. And, you know, once you feel that pain, and especially if you're feeling pain repeatedly, like people with chronic pain do, you know, then it gets a bit more complicated than just electricity. You know, this is in a, you know, a blink of an eye or even faster in terms of how it gets transmitted. Just think about you pulling your hand away from the stove and how things have to go back and forth in that amount of time.
How long does it, in other words, I assume that there has been a timer. When somebody runs a race, someone's got a stopwatch and you time it. Do we know how fast these signals travel through various nerves in the body?
Yeah, and, you know, it depends a little bit on the size of the nerve and where that receptor is. But, you know, in something like your fingers, where it's very fast, you know, we're talking milliseconds, you know, even potentially microseconds.
Amazing. Dr. Julie Politzis joins us today. She is a neurosurgeon at Albany Med. If you have a question, please give us a call, 800-348-2551. In your introduction, it mentioned that one of your interests is the management of chronic pain using stimulation techniques. What are we talking about there?
Well, basically, we're trying to trick the, you know, the, while there's good things like we talked about, you know, removing our foot from that tack or touching a stove, you know, sometimes this system kind of goes haywire and people develop chronic pain. And, you know, that's just generally loosely defined as having pain for more than 3 months and, you know, kind of not normally, you know, because most of us, when we experience pain, it gets better. But then there's a subset of people that unfortunately suffer with chronic pain. And so when we use stimulation, what we're trying to do is trick the brain from recognizing those pain signals into recognizing them as a more benign signal so that, you know, all the sequelae don't happen and people don't feel that same pain response.
Yeah, but how do you do it? What kind of stimulation techniques are we talking about here?
Yeah, so, you know, actually it's a lot of people have pain in their back, and that's one of the most common things that we do. So that's, you know, one of the easiest things to describe. So, you know, if you have pain in an area that's covered by a pair of pants, what we can do is, you know, in the upper spine, we can put a stimulating device, and it's right on the area where all the sensory signals travel. And so what it can do is just emit a signal there that kind of creates a white noise so that it disrupts the signal as it's going up to the brain for that chronic pain aspect.
Fascinating. It's a radio signal?
It's an electrical signal.
And how did we, and without going into great detail, we have to take a break, but how did we get to this point? What research was necessary to say, okay, this frequency, this voltage, this is the way we can manage pain? How did that happen?
That's a great question, you know, and it's still actually being worked on while we play with different, there's a lot of different parameters that can do the same thing. So very recently, people have started tweaking that signal even more to have natural rhythms of the brain is one mechanism of doing this, and one is super high frequency. So, you know, a lot of work from cell culture through animal studies into trying different frequencies with people.
We have to take a break here in 1 minute, and so this is not fair to you in any way, Dr. Julie Politzis. Explain in 60 seconds what deep brain stimulation is and how it works on Parkinson's.
Sure. So basically, it's a pacemaker for the brain, and it's a overnight surgery where we drill a small hole, pass a wire about the size of spaghetti into a nucleus that controls movement. Again, it's kind of creating this white noise, and rather than having abnormal movements, it allows for normalization of those movements. People do amazingly well, are able to oftentimes come off many of their meds and just have much better quality of life because movements become more predictable.
All right. So this deep brain stimulation is primarily used to affect and hopefully improve tremors or that sort of related physical part of Parkinson's. Maybe if we have a chance between calls, and we have a lot of calls already, so maybe not. I'd love to delve into the business of hallucinations with regard to Parkinson's and what you know about that. But first, let's take a break. Dr. Julie Politzis is our guest from Albany Med. She is a neurosurgeon, and we are ready for your calls at 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. The number, if you have a question today, is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by neurosurgeon Dr. Julie Politzis, and we'll get to the phones here in a minute. Completely off topic. Over the Halloween break, I watched a movie called Donovan's Brain. It's an old 50s sci-fi movie, and they have brains in jars. They're alive. Now, question for you before we get to the calls. You know, these brains, they moved, they pulsed, they moved around a little bit. Do brains move at all when you open somebody up to do brain surgery?
I haven't seen the movie, but now I have to make sure to watch it. But, you know, you do see the pulsations. And so that's actually kind of a good sign that you're oxygenating and blood is getting to the brain.
So this is not muscular movement. This is just pulsing of the vascular system?
Exactly.
Amazing. Let's go to the phones now, and we start out with Dan in North Adams. Dan, you're on.
Hey, this is Dan. Hi.
Hi,
doctor. My question is in regard to tremors. I'm 61 years old. I've had tremors my entire life, and I have a twin brother, and he also has the same condition, except no one else in the family has it. And in your intro, you mentioned something about that was something within your scope.
Tremors.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And have you seen a specialist?
In regard to that specifically, no.
Yeah. Okay. And has your primary care doc said anything?
No.
Okay. So, you know, there's multiple different kinds of tremors. The most common is essential tremor. And so, you know, with essential tremor, you have a tremor when you are having an action. So if you're going to take like a drink of water, or you're going to use a spoon, or you're going to write something down, you have that type of tremor. And that can be something that, you know, sometimes but not always runs in families. And that isn't uncommon. Then, you know, there's other kinds of tremors. People just kind of have a physiologic tremor, and that can happen either when, you know, it's kind of normal. It can happen at rest. It can happen with action. It gets worse when you're under stress or you haven't slept much or other things like that. And, you know, that's also fairly common. For Parkinson's, that's generally something that doesn't happen until, you know, later in life if it's going to happen. And that is different in that it happens mostly at rest. And it's almost a rolling tremor is how people describe it. But, you know, those are some of the common things. Again, because this is something you've had for, you know, all your life, you know, I would favor one of the, you know, one of those other two ideas. But what you, you know, what you should do is if it's something that bothers you, is talk to your primary doc. And sometimes, you know, there's different medications that can be trialed or asked to be seen by a neurologist.
Dan, thank you very much for the call. That's an interesting point about medications. And as I understand Parkinson's disease, and it's not very much of an understanding, but there is a percentage, whether it's 30 or 50% of people who suffer from this, who at some point suffer from hallucinations. And my question for you, and I'm sure you have come across this in your work, is this a result of side effects of drugs, or is this something to do with Parkinson's?
Yeah, so, you know, there's the answer can be both. And, you know, there's different medications that are pretty commonly used for Parkinson's disease where people can have hallucinations. And, you know, if you notice you start that medication and, you know, the hallucinations start or worsen, obviously you would report that to your physician and he or she would be likely to take you off that medication or reduce the dose. And so that's common for a subset of people, and they just know, you know, it's kind of like a side effect of that medication. Then there's other people as the disease goes on that do have hallucinations. And, you know, mind you, these aren't, you know, while it's disturbing, no doubt, to see something that isn't there, these are don't tend to be dangerous hallucinations. Often they're commonly, you know, parades or animals or other things that, you know, aren't harmful, but, you know, that does happen due to the disease.
Now, with regard to treatment of the tremor and using deep brain stimulation, how have the outcomes been? How successful have you been with this technique?
They're amazing. You know, I've been, this is, you know, kind of my passion and something where we really have a great subspecialty team at Albany Med. And because of that subspecialty team, we pick the right people for the procedure, because obviously, you know, you don't want to have a procedure if it's not going to give you any benefit, or, you know, even worse, if your risk is greater than the benefit. But in the majority of the people that we treat with tremor, we're able to reduce their tremor by 70% or 80%. And with Parkinson's disease, we're able to oftentimes, you know, do not only that, but come down on medications quite significantly for people. That's a goal for.
Is it a cumbersome thing to do? Obviously, it would seem to be a tremendous upgrade on quality of life, but is this something that is permanently installed?
It is permanently installed. You know, really, it's just, you know, you do have like that pacemaker in the chest and you can feel a couple of little lumps and bumps. But, you know, once you get it to where it wants to go with the help of our movement disorder neurologist, like 3 months in, there's very little tweaking that goes on. You know, you'll come kind of for your annual visit to make sure that everything's still optimized as time goes on. But really, after you get through that, you know, postoperative period, you just leave it alone and go about life.
Astonishing. Dr. Julie Politzis of Albany Med joins us today, and we'll get right to your calls in a second. 800-348-2551. I knew a person years ago who had a pacemaker, and I was floored. This person would, when it was time for diagnostics, would just call a number, hold the phone up to the pacemaker, and all the telemetry would go. And I'm wondering, with this sort of modern technology, this deep brain stimulation that is literally installed in someone, is there a way that you can monitor the telemetry from where you are?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think for the brain technology, you know, the cool bells and whistles like that is a little bit behind pacemaker for the heart technology, just because there's so many more people that have cardiac pacemakers. Having said that, you know, as of the last 6 months or so, there's been major advances where we could try to head in that direction. And, you know, with everything that's going on and people not wanting to, or, you know, restrictions in terms of travel and going outdoors, this could be so beneficial for so many people. So the answer is not quite, but we're on the right track.
Fair enough. Dr. Julie Politzis joins us today, and let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Hey. Charles in Pittsfield. Charles, you're on.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. So I have a son who's had a freak accident about 4 months ago. He has persistent post-concussive syndrome, where he's tired, has headaches, problem focusing, using his eyes for long periods of screen time. Are there any brain stimulation treatments, anything going on that we should consider?
Thanks so much for your question. You know, it's such a tough situation, because even when you have a mild concussion, we know that, you know, there can be side effects like this, and it tends to be, you know, really challenging to recover from. I would tell you that, you know, this has been going on for 4 months, and oftentimes the rehab specialists have a lot of kind of tricks up their sleeve. Sometimes the neuropsychologist can get involved as well for the help with attention focusing and you know, things when things aren't quite right. This will get better from where it is now, likely. The first year is the key year to do this. Unfortunately, with everybody having so much screen time during COVID, it's a little bit tougher because we're relying on that. But, you know, just keep using the brain. Take breaks when you can. And over the year, I anticipate this will get somewhat better. You know, I think in terms of deep brain stimulation for this, we're not there yet. People have started looking at it at in really severe cases, but not kind of for post-concussive syndrome yet.
Charles, thank you very much for the call. Over to Howard in New Paltz. Howard.
Hey, how are you?
Hi.
How are you, Larry? I hope you don't hang up on it too fast. I have two quick ones.
Okay.
One time, I'm a house painter, so I got electrocuted on a ladder once. Pretty bad, where it came through my body, it came out, and burned my hand from inside and came out. And the other thing is I've been studying yoga for like 40 years, you know, deep breathing. Do they find any studies that would help the brain stimulate in all areas from really deep breathing for long periods of time? Oxygen, a lot of oxygen in the brain.
Deep breathing, doctor.
So I heard the part about the electrocuting while on the ladder, and then it got a little bit fuzzy for me for deep breathing. Was that something that you're using to control the situation, or were you looking to see if there was any way that deep brain stimulation could make that better?
Yeah, any study, because I follow this guy named Wim Hof, I think, or something like that. And it's like he claims you could actually... Well, it does help me a lot, but deep breathing, a lot of it will oxygenize your brain and...
Oxygenize your brain. Okay, we got you. Your connection's not too good, Howard, but I think we have you. Go ahead, doctor.
Okay. Yeah, you know, Howard, I'm actually a huge fan of things that involve deep breathing and kind of taking a pause because, you know, your brain is going in so many different directions. And if you need to kind of maximize its efficiency, get it to its best self, taking a pause from everything you're doing and focusing on the breathing makes a lot of sense. There's been a lot of work done with mindfulness and meditation that do show that, you know, you can change the way you perceive things and have better function. So I think that's a great thing that you found to help you out with that.
Howard, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Julie Politzis, a neurosurgeon at Albany Med, joins us today. The number is 800-348-2551. Speaking of deep breathing,
yeah.
I always wonder about surgeons, how they center themselves to do something so delicate and demanding. I can think of nothing more delicate and demanding than doing brain surgery. How do you get to that place that athletes get where you are centered and in the moment?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And, you know, that it's a lifelong practice. You know, I really kind of practice what I preach in this regard and really have developed a big meditation practice and do a lot of yoga as well, you know, because I think that we all owe it to our patients to be the best version of ourselves that we can be when we're taking care of them in the operating room.
Dr. Julie Politzis joins us today. Back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
What type of spacers or inserts are used in hemilaminectomies or laminectomies?
So, you know, the question was about what type of spacers are used in laminectomies. A little bit of this depends in terms of which part of the spine you're at. But, you know, kind of the general principle here is, you know, a laminectomy, you're going to take off the bone, and we can use that when somebody has some arthritis. And, you know, you just need to kind of clean out that area or if they have a herniated disc. The time when spacers are used is when you need a fusion type operation. And often what this is made of is a substance that will enable it to integrate into the bone so that, you know, you're leading to that fusion and the two bones become one with this. There's always a latest, greatest material to see which can make the highest rate of fusions that is composed in that spacer, but also the spacers are hollow, and so other forms of bone growth type materials are placed in that area. And, you know, I think just what people can do to help themselves and help their physician and make this happen is, you know, make sure that, you know, if you're a smoker, if you're going to have a fusion, this is the time to stop smoking. Or if you're a diabetic, make sure that your A1C is as good as it can be, so that all those things can help that fusion take.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. Joined today by Dr. Julie Politzis of Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's grab at least one more here before our next break. We'll go over to Evie in Gloversville. Evie.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Hello, doctor. I just have two comments, if I could. The first is our son, Matthew, is 20. He had brain surgery, like 27 hours worth, when he was a five-year-old, and the seizures went away. The epilepsy, he has epilepsy. His seizures went away for 9 years, and then when he was started puberty at 14, the seizures came back, and he's been on so many medicines. And recently, over the last year, he's been put on the new Epidiolex, the CBD oil that is not approved for all epilepsies yet, but it was approved for his. That's him in the background. We're in the car. So it, instead of having like two seizures a day, every day, the Epidiolex has made him have no seizures for like 3 months.
Wow.
So the Epidiolex, the CBD oil, is just been really great, and hopefully will be approved for all of the epilepsy.
Do you have a question?
So that's my first comment.
Okay.
Yeah, no, and the second thing is, when Maddie was having grand mal in his bed, we got the watch that can alert the parents to the seizure while they're in the bed. But I also came up with where you could put bells on your headboard, and then when the child is having a grand mal, you hear the bells ring, and it's, you know, cheap and expensive, and it's not costly like a watch would be, or a mattress that specializes in detecting epilepsy seizures. Yeah. So that's just my comment.
Okay. Do you want to comment on that at all, doctor?
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, it's I think that parents oftentimes, when their child is suffering with something, come up with some of the most innovative ways to, monitor things or help their child. And, you know, I think you bring up an important point, a couple important points. One, you know, the watch, one of the places that all these devices are kind of moving is to have some kind of objective data that help them, you know, make the decisions as to when to give stimulation and when not. So, you know, the idea here is that we may be able to use these things with Fitbits or our Apple Watches in the future. And, you know, for epilepsy, there are actually a number of interventions, both medicines, as the caller described, as well as devices that really have shown to have meaningful impact. So a lot of options out there right now for people with epilepsy.
Dr. Julie Politzis joins us today. Doc, we'll take a quick break here and then hit the home stretch. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number on Medical Monday. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is our number. We're joined today by Dr. Julie Politzis of Albany Med, who is a neurosurgeon there and a professor of neurosurgery at Albany Medical College. An email here came in about 40 minutes ago, and I got to say, it's one of my favorite emails on a Medical Monday in some time. We don't have a long time for you to answer this very deep question, but give it a shot. This is from Joel in Blooming Grove. Joel writes, As a neurosurgeon who spends her professional life being intimate with the human brain, could the doctor please comment on the nature of consciousness? Good luck, Doc.
Well, I'm sure there's been many a thesis written on this, and it's, you know, it's really a fascinating thing. And many of my colleagues actually have gone on to write books on the topic and related, just because it's such a deep connection with the brain and seeing it as something that's physical, and, you know, then thinking about all the other things it does in terms of making us who we are. So in terms of consciousness, there's actually, you know, it depends how you want to think about this, but if you're just speaking of being conscious or unconscious, you know, there's actually areas in the brainstem that help to control that. And, you know, we've kind of learned a little bit about that in terms of some of the research that's being done, or, you know, and seeing what happens to people when they have a really bad head injury or some sort of event. So we've been able to map out some of the areas that are involved in that. And, you know, then getting back to kind of the deep breathing comment from earlier, you know, we've been able to show that when you get into a meditative state or an alternative state, how the brain behaves varies. So, you know, using MRI, called functional MRI, which lets different areas light up, we're able to tell which of the areas can be altered by these different levels of consciousness.
Is there a soul separate from our consciousness and intellect?
Oh, wow. You know, I think this comes down to personal belief in terms of, you know, how different people feel. And, you know, there's so much about the brain that we don't understand. And, you know, people actually say people only use about 10% of their brain. And there's so much there that is yet to be unlocked. So, you know, it's a really hard question to answer. I will tell you that, you know, unfortunately, sometimes, you know, we deal with people that have had terrible events where they become brain dead. So their heart and their lungs are still working. You know, it's mechanical, you know, using a ventilator, et cetera. But when, you know, people ask, you know, is my loved one still there? I tell them that they are not.
Okay. Well, it was, in fact, a trick question, but you did it very diplomatically, and thank you for answering that question for us. Our number here is 800-348-2551. You mentioned mapping the brain. How much of this brain is now mapped, and what is left to be discovered?
So many things. You know, I think it's so... you know, right now when we're talking about mapping things, we do this in a variety of different ways. So again, we're going to use that functional MRI that allows us to see different connections between different areas. And, you know, we can use electrophysiologic recording like EEG to be able to do that as well. But, you know, what that's only telling us is, you know, where is that physical connection? We don't know the degree to which that connection, you know, there's pathways there, or, you know, wires, to use your electrical analogy from earlier, but how fast things are going, whether it's going one way or the other, whether it's stopping along the way, is very dependent on what a person is doing at that moment in time and a whole other set of parameters. So there is so much to figure out. You know, we're just really at the very tippy top of the iceberg.
Dr. Julie Felitzis of Albany Med joins us. Back to the phones we go, 800-348-2551. Jane in Burbank. Jane, you're on.
Yes. I have numbness, but no pain in my fingers. That would be a muscle problem.
Gina,
how can I correct that?
Say it again, doctor.
What?
Is it in all your fingers, and do you have diabetes?
No, no diabetes. It's in all my fingers. I can't pick up things easily, buttoning. I have to use devices for buttoning buttons.
Well, if you haven't already, I would go speak with your doctor and ask them, you know, either to evaluate you or send you to a neurologist, because, you know, when you can't button buttons, you know, that can be a problem anywhere from your fingertips up into your spine. And you just want to make sure that you haven't developed any arthritis that could be pushing on any of the nerves. So I would make sure to talk to them and have them do a good neurologic exam, because sometimes there's ways that we can make that better or at least not get worse.
Jane, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Carol in Del Mar. Carol, I see that you have emailed us as well, but we'll let you ask the question verbally.
Thank you very much. It seems to me the possibilities for deep brain stimulation to treat neurological issues are still expanding. My specific question is there any research on the capacity of deep brain stimulation to restore vision that has been impaired by a stroke?
Great question. And, you know, I think we are always kind of looking for different things that deep brain stimulation can do. In this particular case, you know, we've looked at deep brain stimulation for stroke, mostly movement related. And some of this depends on where the stroke actually was. So, you know, different parts of the brain are regulated by different areas. And, you know, this, again, is an area of exploration and things that people are looking for. There's been some promising data in the work of stroke. For vision in particular, there hasn't been as much. Again, I think because it's not as common as the movement-related effects, but a really good question and a really potentially exciting area of research, because so much has been done with vision in other ways that it would be a really interesting thing to pursue.
Carol, thank you so much for the call. Over to Elizabeth in Rensselaer County. Elizabeth.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about chronic abdominal pain. And this is a situation that got a lot worse after robotic prostate surgery. He had his gallbladder out because it wasn't a great gallbladder, but it also wasn't a horrible gallbladder. And now we're left with gastro signing off and use of ice packs and pain meds to help. But I wondered if this is something that a neurologist could help with, maybe figure out if there's a nerve that's trapped, or there was a discussion that maybe he has adhesions or scarring from that prostatectomy inside his abdomen.
Absolutely. This is not an uncommon complaint, and people can have pain in the abdomen or even in their pelvis after any of these surgeries. And oftentimes, you know, are kind of in a similar situation that you find yourself in, where what's the next step? So, you know, it kind of depends where the pain is. And so I agree with you, to see a neurologist is important. So that can kind of be determined. And then the treatment is dependent on that. There's a number of different medications and creams that can be used if there's an issue with kind of all the nerves just being hyperactive and not firing correctly. If it's something that's just in a particular area where one of the nerves travels, then sometimes there can be, you know, as you said, a trapped nerve, and figuring out how to deal with that is the next step. But, you know, definitely this is something that you should bring to the attention of a neurologist to see if they can give you any insight.
Thanks very much for the call. Dr. Julie Politsis of Albany Med joins us. You do spinal surgeries as well, correct?
Yes.
How many nerves are bundled in the spinal cord?
You know, a lot would be, you know, the answer to that. In terms of, you know, there's two big groups of bundles, one at the cervical spine and one at the lumbar spine, corresponding to the arms and legs. And, you know, in fact, that your spinal cord ends right at the level of right above your belt, and then there's what we call the cauda equina, or the horse's tail, and that's all those nerves that are traveling elsewise into the pelvis and into the legs. And you know, so in terms of an actual number, I'm not sure, but I think that horse's tail name, it gives it the best analogy, so that you know your audience can think about that, what that would look like.
Someday down the road, is there in your mind the possibility that we will successfully be able to regularly reconnect a severed spinal cord?
That's very hard for a number of reasons. There is work going on with spinal cord injury. So not when it's a complete transection, but when there has been damage. And it's very exciting because this is the first time there's ever really been promise in that area. And so using devices similar to the ones I put in for chronic pain, people are able to stimulate that area, and there have been people that have been able to take some steps that weren't able to walk before. But what's even closer and really bothersome to people that have spinal cord injury is what we call autonomic nerve dysfunction. It's a difficulty controlling blood pressure or heart rate or urinary type symptoms. And these devices have done pretty impressively at controlling some of those symptoms. So again, improving quality of life.
So one step at a time. Dr. Yes. Julie Politzis is our guest. And let's grab a couple of more calls here before we wrap up for the afternoon. Paul is in Kingston. Paul.
Hi, I've been suffering from restless leg, like real bad for years, and I'm wondering if there's any thought to the deep brain stimulation to control that.
Interesting thought, and you know, I think there actually could be some data on that. You know that. I have to go back and familiarize myself with. But why I say there might be some data on that is it's really, and this is not to at all suggest that, you know, there's any Parkinson's going on, but restless leg happens a lot in Parkinson's disease. And yeah. So, you know, there's so many things that could happen with DBS, and we can look and see how it has affected people's restless legs. I will tell you, and, you know, this is just anecdotally in my experience, people tend to complain about it less after this type of surgery. So while it hasn't been used for this condition, we have seen improvement in Parkinson's in the treatment of restless legs. So, you know, again, you guys have given so many ideas.
Parkinson's medications.
Okay.
Some of the medications I take are very powerful, and it's the only way I can get some sleep. I can't sit in a chair for an hour. It's much less than an hour. So it makes life pretty difficult.
And you're seeing a movement disorder specialist? If you haven't seen somebody
go
ahead, doctor.
My primary care doctor has just prescribed some. I take Requip and another drug that finally I can get to sleep, but it really knocks me out, and I'd rather not take medication every night just to sleep. So.
Right. You know, I think it's worth a conversation with your doctor just to see if, you know, any of the movement disorder neurologists down in your area, you know, may just want to have anything else they could add or any other ideas.
All right, Paul, thanks a lot for the call. About 90 seconds left here. Let's go to Ruby in Phoenicia. Ruby, you're on. Hello, Ruby. Are you there? Ruby is gone. No, you there? Hello? Are you there, Ruby?
Yes. Of course, another call came in. Thanks
splendid.
For taking my call.
You got about 30 seconds.
My brother has been having bouts of vertigo for the last few years, sometimes twice a year. And he also has migraines. I'm not sure how often he has a symptom of warmness and fullness in the head. He was diagnosed with vestibular migraines. Can you tell me something about that and what he might be able to do about it?
Yeah, you know, so migraines are awful. And, you know, if you had to couple that with vertigo, I can't even imagine how much he's suffering. I will tell you that, you know, there's vestibular rehab, which he probably has already done, but that's work with a special therapist that can help kind of regulate the ear a little bit. And then in terms of migraines in general, there's been some really big advancements in the last year or so with new medications that can be used that, you know, a lot of people are describing as game changers. So if he hasn't seen his headache specialist recently, I would advise him to do that just to see if any of these new medications may be something that can help.
Dr. Julie Politsis, you've navigated an entire program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great job. Support comes from Nathan Letower Hospital, working to help people manage COVID-19, the flu, and seasonal colds, nlh.org for more information and appointments. Once again, thanks to Dr. Julie Politsis of Albany Medical Center for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Apologies to the 10 or so people still on the line. Show's over, folks. I'm sorry. It's closing time. We'll get them next time. Obviously, you know, we'll do this topic again, and you can call it that time. But again, I'm very sorry. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producers, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. All right, tomorrow at 2 p.m., we'll talk weather with Jason Goff. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.